We do have a guest who's hopefully on his way. There you are. Mr. Vandalin. So before we get to our presentation, a few things have been handed out. So you should have a handout from the New Hampshire Council on Problem Gambling. Representatives are here, and they're going to say a few words after Mark Vandalin's presentation. And then thanks to Patrick Cheatham, we have some information on casinos and crime, looks like this. That's a handout for your perusal. And we have draft reports from White Sands, and you have printed copies of those. I did make some available for the public. They will be posted imminently on the website of the Gambling Regulatory Oversight Authority, which is at www.nh.gov/GROA. I don't think they're posted yet. Is that right?
Not yet.
You just see them.
So there's a lot of material in those draft reports. We'll start going through that after this look at responsible gaming or problem gambling, whatever you want to call it. We'll begin to pick our way through some pretty complicated material. We've got a lot to do once we get into that. So that's the background. Trying to think if there's anything else I wanted to say up front. We have scheduled a meeting for 1 week from today, right here again, in order to have time to grapple with the intricacies of the report that we've received, and then we'll meet again. I believe the meeting after that will be November 8th. Is that right? November 6th. November 6th in the afternoon, 1 to 4. So with that, we are very lucky to have Mark Vandalin here to talk with us about responsible gaming or problem gambling. You can define it as you will. Mr. Vandalin is here from Massachusetts and is director of research and problem gaming at Mass Commission. Can you make your way into that?
That's good.
And has been there since, I think, July, maybe.
Yeah.
And comes from Ohio to Massachusetts, huh?
Iowa.
From Iowa to Massachusetts, and has other important pieces to his background, which I'll let him relate. And Mr. Vandalin, perhaps you could just take it from there. The floor is yours.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Mark Vandalin. I'm the Director of Research and Problem Gambling with the Massachusetts Gaming Commission. I'll kind of go into that a little bit more here in just a minute. I think as I begin, I'm a social worker. I came up kind of as a direct practice social worker for a number of years, and ended up within the Iowa Department of Public Health about 8 years ago, where I was their director of problem gambling treatment and prevention services. And so it was, I learned a lot about administration, about state government, but also about how do you create a system within a state that instance, trial gambling disorders. How do you prevent the disorders to begin with? How do you promote responsible gambling in a state that has an abundance of gambling opportunities? And I think that's ultimately what led me to Massachusetts, is a continued concern for that issue. As Massachusetts looks at expanded gaming opportunities, how do we make sure that that system is carried forth? Massachusetts already had a pretty mature system, but with expanded gaming, it also creates a lot of opportunities for them to continue to revise their system and improve what they're doing. I began with the Massachusetts Gaming Commission just about 4 months ago, and so I say that kind of as excuse me if I'm not quite as articulate on some of these issues as I will be if I admit to this to you later on down the road. But I think that I have a good grasp, especially with an understanding of problem gambling, an understanding of the need for responsible gaming, and how do we translate that into regulation? How do we translate that into a system of care across the state of Massachusetts? So this all starts with the 2011 Expanded Gaming Act. And the 2011 Expanded Gaming Act really does a good job of outlining what are the requirements as Massachusetts opens up casinos in a slot parlor, or looks towards that. And it gives very specific guidance on how it's to be regulated. It establishes a gaming commission within Massachusetts. So there's five gaming commissioners within the state of Massachusetts that are charged with overseeing the implementation of the Expanded Gaming Act. It gives them a lot of direction within that statute, but then it also gives them pretty broad authority to move forward with expanding the gaming opportunities within Massachusetts. And so, just real quick, where do we stand with this issue? The ultimate goal is that there will be three casinos and one slot parlor within the state. The applications are closed, and there are three applicants for a slot parlor within the state that are being reviewed right now, and we anticipate that a determination on who the successful bidder will be for right around, I think it's the 10th of January. There are, right now out to bid, there are two areas for two resort-level casinos. There's a lot of activity on who the applicants are and where those casinos will be in the state of Massachusetts right now. There's a process of winning acceptance within the area where the casino would be through a referendum in those areas through agreements between the applicant or the casino operator and the community which they would be in. Mostly what I wanted, and Chairman Ames had asked me to talk about today, was what is the framework that's been set forth to mitigate problem gambling within Massachusetts? And I would say more specifically, what does it look like within the Massachusetts Gaming Commission? And that's the piece that I really want to focus on. So when the Expanded Gaming Act was passed in 2011, what did it say needed to be done? And what is the authority of the Gaming Commission to address problem gambling? I'm going to start off with funding. And I'll start off with funding because that kind of leads the direction of a lot of the different efforts that we're able to do. And then I'll talk about the research that we're doing, the regulations that will happen within the casino environment that they're looking towards. And then finally, I'm sorry, what do I see as overall the strengths of what Massachusetts has done with the statute? So the funding of that's embedded within the Expanded Gaming Act, specifically funding for what we're calling the public health trust funding. First, and this is once the casinos and slot parlor are fully functional, if money is assessed against each of the licensees, it can be up to $5 million that would be assessed against these licensees. And so we would be talking four different licensees, up to $5 million. The second source would be 5% of their gross revenue for the, not for the slot part of it, 5% of revenue of the resort casinos. Okay. What do we anticipate that to be? Once it's up and running, once these casinos are fully functional and the slot parlor is fully functional, we anticipate that will be between $15 and $20 million a year that would be going into a public health trust fund. There's a third source of funding for this that's temporary, and that's just money that's fronted by the commission to get this piece rolling. It would be money that's launching our research agenda. It would be money to pay for my position that helps to kind of connect the dots between all the pieces that need to be happening. I won't go into too much detail about that right now, but the statute and the public health trust fund is the main driver of this. So the public health trust fund, and I'm going to quote directly from the statute, is to assist social services and public health programs dedicated to addressing problems associated with compulsive gambling, including gambling prevention and addiction services, substance abuse services, educational campaigns to mitigate the potential addictive nature of gambling. Okay, so and then it also indicates within the public health trust fund that the annual research agenda is funded. All right, so basically, from the way that we're interpreting this is that the services funded that will be it's the Department of Public Health. I'm sorry, let me back up a second. This is where I'm not quite as articulate on these issues as I will be down the road. I get my talking points down. But the trustee of the Public Health Trust Fund is the Department of Health and Human Services within the state of Massachusetts. It's the Secretary of Health and Human Services there. So that person would be that person is in charge, the trustee of the Public Health Trust Fund, and it's with the advice and consent of the Massachusetts Gaming Commission. Advice and consent of the Massachusetts Gaming Commission. So I think the intent of that by the legislation is that we work together to address the issues that I specifically mentioned, to address compulsive gambling, including gambling prevention, addiction services, substance abuse services, educational campaigns to mitigate the potential addictive nature of gambling. So we need to be working together in order, all the way from the beginning, where we're drafting regulations and what's happening in the casino environment, to where services are being delivered to persons who have gambling problems, who've been affected by gambling problems, and the prevention services to help stop that from beginning. I'm going to move on and talk about the research agenda. And so the research agenda is actually within the expanded gaming act, within the statute, is quite specific. And I think interestingly so. Just real quick to kind of key this up. I've worked in this field for a long time. I've worked in Iowa. I've consulted with a number of other states. Never have I seen such specific language within statute that talks about how to address problem gambling. Never have I seen such intentional efforts to put research at the forefront of this issue. And that's why I want to really kind of hit home the piece about the research that we're doing. So the research agenda is... let me just kind of tell you where a little bit about the section that the research agenda is in. It's in section 71 of the statute. So the commission, with the advice of the Gaming Policy Advisory Committee, shall develop an annual research agenda in order to, one, understand the social and economic effects of expanded gaming within the Commonwealth. And two, obtain specific information relative to the neuroscience, psychology, sociology, epidemiology, and etiology of gambling. That's incredibly specific. We right now have launched what we're a baseline study, a large baseline study, that we're looking at a couple different things. We're looking at setting a baseline for social and economic variables, looking at very specific indices, both at state level, at a regional level, and at a local level where the gaming establishments will be, so that we can create a system that we ultimately, when we come back after the baseline and do annual reviews of this data, that we'll be able to tell what is the impact of gambling within the state of Massachusetts, all the way down to the local level. What is the impact? We want to know where is it succeeding at our ultimate goal, which is, you know, to bring more jobs, more economic resources to the state. Where is it that we need to target some of the resources from the public health trust fund, so that we mitigate to the extent possible that we can the harms caused by gambling disorders and public gambling. Okay. We also, as part of this baseline study, taking a look at what is the prevalence of gambling, what is the prevalence of problem gambling within the state at this point. Prevalence being what percentage of the state population at this point has some level of a gambling problem, and whether it be we're talking about the full criteria via the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual, the full criteria of a gambling disorder, or some level of gambling problems within their lives. We're also taking a look and doing kind of an inventory of what are the services that are available in the state right now. What are the treatment services that are available? How does prevention of problem gambling, what does that look like within the state at this point? So in some ways, it's looking at kind of a map. What are our existing resources for this issue at this point in time? I think that with the idea that let's do this math and let's figure out where we need to go, so that we can, from the onset, use these public health trust fund dollars to the best way that we possibly can. Okay. There's also an ongoing research agenda. The ongoing research agenda is intended to take a look at comprehensive legal factual studies of the social and economic impacts of gambling in the Commonwealth. That some topics it gives an example of topics as included but not limited to a review of existing state, federal, state, local, Indian, tribal government policies and practices with respect to legalization or prohibiting of gambling, an assessment of the relationship between gambling and levels of crime and existing enforcement and regulatory practices intended to address any such relationships, and an assessment of pathological or problem gambling, including its impacts on individuals, families, businesses, institutions, and the economy.
I'm sorry, was that from the statute?
That is from the statute,
yeah.
That's correct. So, and on an annual basis, the commission will make recommendations that reflect the results of the research. So this is another powerful piece of the statute, is that it doesn't let the research agenda sit over in a corner someplace where we're spending a lot of money and a lot of resources taking a look at the issue. It brings it back around so that we're on an annual basis making recommendations to the legislature on what did we find out and what do we do with it now? So in a lot of ways, we can continuously tweak the system that we have. We can continuously look to expand and enhance the services that are there. Okay. I also wanted to talk about, so I'm going to transition away from the research agenda at this point. And I want to talk about other areas within the statute that provides direction to us on how we're addressing problem gambling. Let's see. Make sure I got my notes right. So within the casino environment, There's specific language within it to talk about several different issues. I'm going to hit kind of what I see as the highlights of it, and it in no way encompasses all the different things that we'll be doing. But there's direction of providing an on-site counseling space within the business. And so the casino operator isn't directed to provide services, but they're directed to provide an on-site counseling space. What happens in that space, how that space is utilized, is basically up to the commission and probably a lot of discussions and collaboration that we'll have to figure out how is that space going to be maximized. It provides a lot of direction on self-exclusion. And self-exclusion, for those of you who don't know, it's exactly that. It's an individual can say to a casino operator, I have a problem with gambling. I don't want to gamble at this establishment. I don't want to gamble at the state any longer. So they can sign up on put themselves on the self-exclusion list. And if they violate that self-exclusion agreement, they would forfeit any of the winnings that they would have received. They would be escorted off the property, and I think that it may even dictate that they would be cited for trespassing. So what it's intended to do is cut the person off from the gambling opportunities around them. This is something that's common practice in most states in most states where there are casinos. A lot of lotteries have this as well. And Massachusetts is looking to, we'll be setting up a self-exclusion program in the state as well. It provides direction on casino employee training with specific regards to problem gambling and responsible gambling. This is important in a couple of different ways. One, casino employees are a high-risk group for gambling disorders, for substance use disorders, for a number of different reasons. So we want to make sure that there's education provided to the casino employees as a reference high-risk group. It's also provided to them because, obviously, within the casino environment, that there will be people there who are problem gamblers. It's intended to assist them in recognizing, knowing how to manage those situations. It's, I think, also an increased awareness and increased understanding of the issue allows them to be more effective.
Let me interrupt you just for a sec. There are four people standing at the door. There are chairs. There's a couple in there, and you can sit at the end of the table here, too. So if you want to come in, please do. Okay, I'm sorry.
Okay. The statute is a little more general, but still requires the operator to identify and have in place specific policies to address problem gambling. To some degree, we'll be dictating what those look like, but we're also interested in seeing what are the applicants putting forth and proposing through their applications and how they would do that. A lot of the operators that are coming forth and a lot of the applicants who are coming forth hoping to be licensees are operators in other states and have to some degree policies and procedures already in place to address problem gambling. We would hope that those policies will continue to spread within Massachusetts. And that they would be in place. But we also may have regulations that would be in place that would enhance those measures to address problem gambling. There are specific requirements within the statute that about posting payback statistics on slot machines, making sure that information is available about problem gambling helpline and the help that's available to problem gamblers, and an overall commitment to responsible gaming. Then there's also a kind of when I talk about we're going to put forth regulation that will provide some direction in these areas, specifically about self-exclusion, about what are on gaming machines, how gaming machines function, and how what measures are taken to help prevent problems with gambling disorders. We have the authority to establish regulation as a commission that would address these specific issues. I don't want to pretend like there's this great body of evidence out there that says this is absolutely what works, this doesn't work, because this is a relatively new field. The body of evidence, the body of research that's out there is pretty slim pickings. And the research that is there, by and large, we're not looking at replication studies. We're looking at our best guesses still at what are effective practices in this area. Our hope as the commission would be that whatever measures that we put into place, that we would continue to evaluate over time and refine what our practices are that to make sure that they are effective and change or drop what is not effective. On Monday, the 28th of October, we're hosting a responsible gaming forum, the goal of this forum is to establish a framework specifically for Massachusetts on responsible gaming. So it would be a document that would help define exactly what our regulations will be in regards to responsible gaming. It'll help our gaming operators who will eventually be there understand where we are as a commission, where we take what our stance is on responsible gaming, to help them establish their own practices as well. We've invited a host of different experts from around the United States and even from Canada to come. I know Chairman Ames is planning on attending that event, and it's certainly open to anybody else who'd like to get more information from the leading innovators and researchers on this area.
Thank you.
So what do I find that is stand out about what is happening? One, I think it's the extensive and clear language about mitigation of problem gambling. That even within its mission statement, that addressing the unintended consequences of gambling is embedded within the mission statement. This is not something that I've seen within other gaming commissions, and it's something that I think that it started within the Expanded Gaming Act and has carried through and has been taken very seriously by the Gaming Commission. To my knowledge, there isn't another gaming commission where they have a position like mine within that commission. I think that that's I think that it's great. I think it's both symbolic as well as very logistically smart, so that we are able to take it from the point where gaming operations happen and the regulations that we have in place, all the way through to the community-based providers who are providing services to problem gamblers, who are doing prevention services, and that we're able to weave this together. I think that the aggressive research agenda is great. We're conducting world-class research in this area. There isn't a lot. And when I said there isn't a lot of research in this area, there really isn't. There's no funding. There's no true strong funding sources. It's not covered by any type of federal funding. If you take a look at the equivalent of substance abuse services, there's a Substance Abuse and Mental Health Services Agency within the federal government. There's NIDA, the National Institute on Drug Abuse. There's a host of federal agencies that take a look at substance abuse and mental health issues. None of them are specifically directed to look at gambling disorders and provide treatment for gambling disorder. It's across the board, across the country, it has been left up as a state-by-state issue. And as a state-by-state issue, there hasn't been enough of interest in conducting solid research in this area. There has been an interest in helping. There's been an interest in making sure that treatment's available. But looking at collaboration amongst states, looking at ways that we can make sure that research is advancing and informing practice hasn't happened all that much. The National Center for Responsible Gaming is probably the one. It's a national organization with a relatively limited budget, but they are the only group that's doing the type of true national research. Massachusetts now is stepping forward. The research that we have underway, it's a $3.5 million research project in order to establish this baseline, to do this baseline study. Let's see. So I had a couple other points that I wanted to make. So the other piece of the research agenda is this avenue for our research to be put into practice. I don't know where New Hampshire is necessarily going with that, but I think that whatever the practice is, to make sure that it loops back around to make sure that what you're doing has some way to come back around and be evaluated so that it can be revised and improved upon. Again, I'm relatively new to the state of Massachusetts. I'm definitely new to the New England area too. I think I don't pretend to sit here and be kind of a true authority on this matter as relatively new to the state of Massachusetts. But I think my perspective is one that I understand gambling disorders both as a clinician and administrator. I understand gambling disorders in terms of what's happened across the country. I have a pretty good understanding of what's already happened. I'm excited about where the potential is to go forward with this. And the last point I want to make about going forward with this is I think that wherever New Hampshire does go with it, we're a small enough geographic area that I think that there's all sorts of potential that where collaboration could happen, whether it be self-inclusion, whether it be research, whether it be policy-related issues. I think it's a fascinating idea, and one that I know that we as a commission would welcome that discussion.
Thank you. Yeah, so we're going to launch into questions, and I see Senator Ash already has his hand up.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Happy to start it out. Welcome to New Hampshire.
Thank you. I've never been to New Hampshire before, and it was beautiful.
Well, being new to the state, you probably don't realize that the state of the Commonwealth of Massachusetts and the state of New Hampshire have a brotherly love relationship. We love their citizens to come to New Hampshire and spend the money when they go home.
I'll be sure to grab a meal before I do.
But that said, you have focused so much on funding for the problem gambling. So I would like your comments on Massachusetts getting gambling and having $15 million to look into the problem gambling issue. If we have it, their citizens will come up here, go back home, you've got revenue from your state. But if, in fact, we do not have gambling up here, our citizens go to Massachusetts and come home, we have zero. The state of New Hampshire funds nothing for problem gambling now, even though, unbeknownst to a lot, even myself, I've been pro-gambling, we have a lot more gambling than I realized in the form of charitable gambling. So your comments on the relationship between two bordering states in problem gambling, if one has revenue, the other one doesn't, any comments based on your experience with the problem gambling?
Absolutely. I think you highlight one of the reasons why if you look at a map and how gaming expansion has happened across the United States, you highlight one of the reasons how it's happened and why it's happened is that It's difficult because these are state-by-state issues. It's a state-by-state issue in how it's legalized and how it's regulated. When I was in Iowa, exact same issue, where it was regulated, it was resource-rich in terms of how it was addressing the money that was able to put towards addressing problem gambling. But our neighbor and just over the river from three casinos in Nebraska had absolutely no funding to address it. And certainly boundaries don't dictate the flow of traffic to and from these casinos or the problems that are caused. I acknowledge your point. I don't necessarily have an answer to how to resolve that other than to say, what are the potential? I have some ideas just based on my experience, Senator. And it would be, so what are the roles of the councils within the states? How can policy be crafted in a way that would allow persons from one state to receive services in another state? I think that there are all sorts of creative ways in which we could go about doing that. States have historically not really done a lot in terms of collaboration. The boundaries are pretty firm, even though they're very permeable when it comes to gamblers passing to and from.
Follow
up? Sure.
But again, the key to what you hope to do with research in that still focuses on funding being generated from the facilities where there is legalized gambling.
Yes.
Thank you so much, and thank you for coming today. I was struck by your comment about the employees of a gambling establishment being themselves a high-risk group, and I wondered if you could elaborate on that a little more, because, of course, one of the things that I think we're all very concerned about is creating jobs, creating good jobs, and I'd like to hear a little more about whether the jobs we're creating come with built-in problems.
I think that, gaming employees have a lot of different stresses that are put on them. A lot of professions have different stresses that are placed on them. I think that gaming employees are in an environment where gaming employees are in an environment. They're drawn to this type of field for some specific reasons. So problem gamblers may more likely be drawn to this type of profession to begin with. They're in an environment where they see people gambling all day long, and it creates an environment where it is more normalized. I think that specifically, for example, dealers within blackjack dealers or poker dealers are a lot of times under a lot of stress, that there's a lot of physical fatigue from those positions. You hear a lot of injuries that are repetitive motion injuries. The likelihood of substance abuse, medication abuse from those individuals is much higher than the general population. We have other experts, Kathy Scanlon, among them, from the Massachusetts Council of Compulsive Gambling, is here and probably can speak more articulately than I can about some of this.
I should say, and I should have said at the beginning, that after we're finished with you, Kathy Scanlon and Ed Talbot are going to say a few words. Director McIntyre.
To follow up on Senator Rush's point, good morning as well, sorry, I should have said that first. The baseline study you're fielding, is it mass only?
It is mass.
My question has to do with the direction of the funds that are taken in for the 5% of revenue for the public health trust fund and then the money aside except against the licenses. So those funds are going to be used both for the research and any service providing as well.
Correct.
Is there any sort of that you're not, I work idea with the breakdown as that as to how much towards research, how much towards direct services?
We don't have that piece worked out yet. I think to some degree it will vary from year to year depending on what type of research agenda is being adopted. For example, right now we are in a period where it's a very expensive research agenda to establish this baseline. 5 years down the road, that research agenda might be much, much smaller, depending on what the identified priorities are. That baseline study to cost will just compare with that.
And once those decisions are made, so you've got the Public Health Trust Fund, which the trustee will be the Commissioner of Health and Human Services, with the advice and consent of the Gaming Commission. So are they going to be the ones making those budgetary decisions, or will it go back to the legislature?
It's the budgetary decisions are made by the Secretary of Health and Human Services, with the advice and consent. It is not directed by the legislature.
And my last question for you is, and you may have said this, if you did, I apologize. How much money does Massachusetts currently expend on services for gaming?
Well, the
problem gaming, I should say.
For problem gaming?
Yeah.
I would defer to Kathy, but I think it's roughly $1.3 million is the amount of money that is directed towards the issue, and that's funding from the lottery. And much of that is directed towards the Massachusetts Council on Compulsive Gambling. The fiscal agent for that, the state agency that's responsible for that, is the Department of Public Health.
Oh, this is one question. So in addition to the Public Health Trust Fund, which will be directed by Health and Services with the advice of the consent of the commission, you also have another agency, is that a state agency, the Massachusetts Council?
Or? The Massachusetts Council on Compulsive Gaming is a nonprofit agency.
Okay. And that's, does that provide services, or?
No, actually, I would defer that question to Kathy, who works for the Mass Council, but I'm sure she'll address that.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, I have a few questions. Did you have a question?
No.
Just a couple of specifics first. Who do you report to?
Who do I report to?
Yeah.
There's an executive director within the commission, Rick Day, is the executive director. I also am accountable to the commissioners themselves.
And then your regulations on problem gaming, what I think I heard you say fairly clearly is that they haven't been developed yet. And yet you're going through a selection process with applicants for licenses. And, the question is whether the absence of specificity around what's going to be expected of these applicants once they get the license is thought to be a problem or not?
Yeah, you know, it's a really interesting question. And in a lot of ways, we're figuring some of this out as we move forward. So within the application, for example, within the application for the slot licenses, there's 10 questions that they're asked about how they plan to mitigate problem gambling, how they will address problem gambling, how they will connect with community resources, what policies and procedures they have in place. These are all good, and it will be great to see how these applicants are responding to these questions. It doesn't necessarily mean that we will also have regulation that will be in place. And that regulation is driven by direction that we have in the statute, and also then we have the ability to promulgate regulation in addition to that. That has not necessarily been established yet, but the operators will be held accountable. So it's you're right. There is a sort of this is what the statute says, and certainly their applications know what the statute says. This is what their practices are within other jurisdictions. And then there's this whole other piece that's going to bring in. It is the regulation that's yet to be established.
So in effect, they understand what the statute says. They know that you've reserved your right to implement that statute with additional specificity that may surprise them, and they know they're taking that risk as they go into this. Is that right?
That's absolutely right.
Okay. Then I've read some of this research on problem gambling, I certainly concur with your view that it's both sparse and uneven. I'm not sure you said uneven, but it's uneven. In part because of what I see as an absence of a common definition of problem gambling. What is it? And then the tools that are used in the research vary so that the results can't be, it's sort of apples and oranges trying to compare one to the other. And maybe you could either confirm what I've just said or add to it.
You know, one of the, and this is the thing about when we have no federal direction on this issue, and states are left to kind of define their own path on this, the way in which data is collected, the way in which the issue is defined, and the screening instruments that are used for to determine whether or not a problem exists, there's a lot, there's not a lot of consistency. There's identified best practices. The DSM is kind of the guiding document on this, but the screening instruments that are used to determine the problem, there's not a lot of consistency there. And so it creates a lot of confusion within the field, creates some skepticism as well. We talked about ways that we can all collaborate. I think that is absolutely wonderful. Let's have some common definitions here. Let's see how we can collaborate on definitions, on evaluation processes, on screening instruments, on best practices.
Yeah, that's fine. And moving on from that, there's certainly a current of opinion that says it's not the people who gamble with the machines, it's the machines that are the problem. Limits need to be set on the machines, not take them away, but set some kind of limits on. We've heard in our own review about limits that can be set on near misses, and maybe there's other aspects of that you could talk about.
Sure. You've done some great on this issue. I appreciate the research that you've done, and there is a debate that's going on about what needs to happen. How should we look at modifying the machines? Is it the machines that are addicted, or the persons that are playing machines that are addicted? I think that we need to pay attention to both areas here. I think absolutely we need to rubric that to make sure that information is provided about the nature of gambling, about the risks of gambling, make sure that people have the tools that if they want to do some type of free commitment where they say, this is how much I want to gamble, this is how long I want to gamble, that is an option for them. There's all sorts of tools that can be used to modify gaming machines. Whether that's establishment of free commitment rules that are embedded in the machine, whether that's time clocks on the machine, whether that's how much a person has spent in dollars versus credits, and that that's posted on the machine. There are different modifications that you can make to a machine that would provide a better informed player. That would hopefully
with the idea that the better informed player is less likely to be a problem gambler. I think those are my questions. Are there any other questions? Yes, sir.
Sorry. problem gamblers are, if you don't have a casino, but you still have sporting events that people gamble on, most states still have bingo or other things. A problem gambler, does it matter what the vehicle is? I mean, if a problem gambler is a problem gambler, do they pick whatever is available to them?
It depends. You know, I mean, there's to say that there's no, you only have problem gamblers when you introduce casinos is wrong. People gamble in all sorts of ways. It's the lottery. It's casinos. It's some people say that high risk trading in the stock market is gambling. I worked in Iowa, and some people said, investing in futures and farming was a form of gambling. Gambling can take on a number of different forms, and it really doesn't matter. And in my experience in this field, you may have some people that gamble, that are problem gamblers that gamble exclusively on one form of gambling, but by and large, what you see are people that gamble in a number of different ways. They make the favorite.
Commissioner Brackman.
Good morning. To follow up on the Senator's question, is there any, since we agree this is all forms of gaming that's taking place in New Hampshire at this time, is there any type of research that's been done to indicate what would happen by bringing in another casino, a commercial casino into the state? Would we see, is there any data to suggest that we'll see an increase in problem gaming? Or that the gaming is already occurring, you wouldn't see the increase.
There's debate on that issue as well. So the question is, so when you introduce a casino to a specific area, would you see the number of problem gamblers or problem increase in that area? There's absolutely data that would suggest that when you put a casino someplace, when you expand gaming, when you put a different form of gambling in someplace, that the people in the immediate area are at higher risk of gambling problems or problems related to the gambling. There's also a pretty good body of evidence that said that even if you would see that, any type of initial spike in that if they adapt over time and return to the levels that would be pre-expansion of whatever that form of gaming is. When I worked in Iowa, we did a large study looking at, so what are there increases in problems within a 50-mile radius of where they have 21 casinos? I think it's actually probably what's happening in Iowa is very relevant to where New Hampshire is going just in terms of demographics and how rural the state is, from what I know. But so do you see an increase in problems? There was an increase in the number of calls to the helpline. There was an increase in number of persons per capita seeking problem gambling help within the proximity of the casino. We did not necessarily see an increase in other social or economic or social variables or indices like crime, domestic violence, substance abuse. But these are still some issues that are up for debate because there isn't a lot of replication of these exact studies going on around the country. So I'm just highlighting some of the different thoughts on these issues.
General Foster.
This is a follow-up to the Senator's question. Is there any well-regarded research that indicates certain types of gaming is more inclined to cause problem gaming as or video slot machines different than gaming tables or horse racing or some other sort of events, or is it just not clear that to you?
No, I haven't seen research specifically in that area. I know, I'm most familiar with the data from Iowa that of the persons who came to treatment, that around 65% said that their game of choice, the way that they primarily gambled, was on the slot machines. The slot
Okay, well, I think we'll conclude this part of the morning, and thank you so much for coming up from Massachusetts.
Thank you.
I think this, for me, and I'm sure for everyone, has been most helpful.
If I could just say, if there's massgaming.com is the website for the Massachusetts Gaming Commission. It's it, on that contains the actual statute. It contains the obligations that our applicants are responding to. It contains a wealth of information about the expanded gaming act in Massachusetts and how we're moving forward.
Yeah. Thank you.
Thank you.
And Mr. Talbot, and sorry, the two of you are coming up? Or?
Yes,
you're
coming.
Yeah.
So let me just tell you a little bit about that. We're a private nonprofit. We were started in 1983 by a gentleman who had a gambling problem. And when he went to look for help, he realized there was none there. In 1987, the council was funded. And the council was and still is funded today mainly through lottery funding. The lottery stepped up and said, we understand that there's a problem and we want to help out. So, and what the Massachusetts Council does is provides, we advocate for services. We've advocated for treatment services, which there were none in Massachusetts at the time we started. And we don't do the treatment ourselves. We do education and training. We do advocacy. We do public awareness. One of the first things we needed to do was awareness that there are services, because nobody's going to seek those services if they're not, if they don't know that they're there. And we also do outreach through Helpline, and at this point, not only Helpline but website, a lot of contact with people who are looking for help. So. That's a little bit of a glimpse of what the Massachusetts Council does. Did that answer your question about the Massachusetts Council? Okay. What else did you ask that I wanted to ask to answer a question on? Your question about the research on specific types of problem gambling, what's the most specific type of gambling? There is what Mark described was very clear about the question on our slot machines more difficult for people than others. But there is some research that comes out of Harvard Medical School that has come up with that it isn't specifically for a lot of people, it isn't specifically the type of gambling, but it's how many types of gambling that they do become involved in that for them will indicate, those are going to indicate the problem gamblers. That seemed to be what that study, which was a very reliable study, showed. Doesn't say that there isn't one that's more problematic, but that seems to be going in the direction of saying, it really isn't. It's really more how many different types of things people are involved in. I just want to mention maybe three things today. One is the what's problem gambling. That's always a question. I know somebody asked you today, what is it? And I did bring for you and passed around that what people have been referring to as the DSM-5. It's the American Psychiatric Association's Diagnostic and Statistical Manual version 5. Just came out, and it talks about disordered gambling, which is the term that's being preferred rather than some of the other terms you hear. You hear compulsive gambling, you hear problem gambling, you hear pathological gambling. The term disordered gambling seems to be less pejorative, a little bit more able to be understood by people on what it is. So if you have time to read that and you have interest, it really lays out exactly what compulsive gambling, disorder gambling is, what it, how it looks like, how it's relates to other disorders. And on the very first page, if you only read one part, there's 10 criteria that are listed on the first page. A person needs to have at least 4 of them to be considered a disordered gambler. So that might help a little bit with some of the understanding of what the problem is. The definition that the people seem to be using is from the DSM-5, persistent and reoccurring, not just once in a lifetime, but persistent and reoccurring problematic gambling behavior that leads to, and this is important, that leads to some kind of significant distress or impairment. A lot of people will say to us, well, geez, I do this a lot. Is that a problem? It's a problem if it's causing problems and you're still continuing to do it. So that's kind of a good criteria. And then the specific criteria on that handout that you have. The other thing I want to kind of mention is something that Mark said I think is really important, is the do increasing gambling opportunities lead to increased problems? It's always a question people want to know. And again, there is some debate about it, and what Mark said is exactly accurate. Within the 50 radius, you know, things 50 mile radius, problems do seem to increase. One of the other pieces of study that are out there talk about adaptation, and that as human beings, that's something that we naturally do, is adapt to new things that come out. So they have found that in some of these areas where new gambling is introduced, there does seem to be a early on bump in problems. And that at some point, adaptation seems to kick in, and that some of those problems seem to decline a bit. However, some of the things that aren't known is how long does that take? How long are the problems increasing before they start to decline a bit? And the other question is, what made that happen? What are the interventions that either were or weren't there that made that happen or made that not happen? And the other piece that's, I think, important to pay attention to is even though there is some increase in gambling and then some decline, increase in problems with gambling, some decline, the levels don't ever seem to go back to quite where they were before that extra gambling was introduced. So the reason I'm saying this is it really makes me thrilled that you're paying attention to this because there are problems that are associated with the increase of gambling. However, the important thing to remember is, you know, somebody said it here earlier, there's already problems in New Hampshire. There's already significant problems with people having with their gambling, whether there's casinos or not. So I know in Massachusetts, the largest number of phone calls that come to our helpline are from people who are having trouble with scratch tickets, lottery, and mainly scratch tickets. That's by far the biggest number. And, you know, there's great regulation in the casino bill in Massachusetts, and there's anticipation for a certain amount of money coming in. However, the lottery in Massachusetts brings in over $4 billion a year, maybe six or seven at this point. That's more that's anticipated from the casinos put together. So to, you know, it's right and just that the lottery is the one who is funding the efforts in Massachusetts at this point, and that they don't intend for those to go away when the casinos come in because it's a partnership between all the different types of gambling. The racetracks also contribute funding to the Council on Gambling in Massachusetts. And then I guess the last point I want to say is, so, you know, if increased gambling does present problems, what are we going to do about it? What's to be done? And I think I'm going to say that the New Hampshire Council, that Ed will talk about in a second, the New Hampshire Council is really asking that you do the same thing that we ask in Massachusetts, is that you put as much effort into minimizing the harms as you do into maximizing benefits. Everybody knows you're doing this for a good reason. You know, you want jobs, you want income for the state, you want entertainment for folks. These are all great reasons. And people are going to work hard to maximize those benefits. What we're asking as a New Hampshire Council and what we did in Massachusetts was ask that you work as hard to minimize the problems. And I think that's a fair standard. What does that mean? We had that discussion with our governor and executive office of Health and Human Services. Like, what does that mean? What are we going to do? And my answer to that would be that you provide a comprehensive public health response to the problem. And what that means is that you don't just look at the clinical response. You know, the clinical response is what the DSM-5 talks about. You've got an individual with a problem, and you figure out how to help that person. When you look at it from a public health perspective, you say, let's look at the whole community. Let's assure the health of the whole community. You take a community approach rather than an individual problem approach. So what we're asking for is a comprehensive public health response, which would include, well, you know what I want you to do for that is take a look if you have the paper behind
They didn't get them over there. So
there
are only about 7 copies of the
Okay. Well, I'll get a couple more. Sorry about that. Thank you. Those are the levels in which the DSM-5. Thank you. So this one with the levels, this is what we're talking about when we talk about a comprehensive public health response. And I'm going to back into it a little bit by talking about a continuum of problems. And you seem to have three or four levels that are identified. One is level zero, where there's people who don't gamble. There actually are some. Not many, but there are some left in this planet that don't gamble. Then you have people who gamble, level one gamblers, people who gamble with no adverse consequences, no problems. They simply gamble for entertainment and fun. And that's the majority of people. I think that number is probably in the 70-something, 80%, maybe about 20% nationally, not in New Hampshire necessarily, but nationally, about 20% who don't gamble, about almost 80% who gamble but don't have any problems with it. And then you get into the area called unhealthy gambling or disordered gambling or problem gambling, where you have a smaller percentage of people who gamble with some problems. And then you have an even smaller percentage of people who gamble with serious problems. Okay, so that's the whole universe of people you're looking at. And what I would suggest is that you don't just look at level three, the people with very serious problems, which is what gets the most attention, actually. That's what you read stories in the paper about, and they're the smaller percentage of people. But what we're hoping is that you would look at that whole range and make sure that there's efforts in zero level and level one to keep those people in those levels. You don't want, when you introduce new gambling, you don't want people who have no problems with gambling to all of a sudden develop them. Well, and for that, in that situation, what you would do is look at high-risk groups and what can you do to prevent these problems from occurring with high-risk groups. You heard about casino employees being high-risk groups. Adolescents and college-age students are high-risk groups. Elderly are high-risk groups. There's a number of vulnerable populations that you want to make sure when you introduce new gambling don't have problems that they didn't have before. And then with level two gamblers, people are having some problems. Maybe they don't meet the diagnostic code that we just passed out, but they're still having problems. And you know, we get calls from some of those people on our helpline, and we don't say to them, oh, wait till the house is gone and your job is gone and your family has left, and then call us back. We try to say, here's what you can do at this point to not progress into level three gambling and to hopefully move back into level one where you don't have any problems. So, you know, interventions along that line, public awareness, helplines, education, things like that, education again with vulnerable groups. And then level three, what you certainly want for that is people who meet some diagnostic code. You want treatment available. And again, you want a range of treatment options available. Some people, outpatient counseling is fine. Some people need inpatient residential treatment. So there's some other, you know, treatment interventions, day treatment for people that can be offered, similar to what's offered in substance abuse field. And then you have a tiny little one there we might not even mention, but it's the level four, people who actually have serious problems who will seek treatment. With all the addictions, you find that a majority of people don't enter into formal treatment. But there's some research that we found through the, I think it was through the National Household Survey of Problems. I think that was a study. They've indicated that a number of these people will show up in other healthcare systems. They'll show up in their primary care. They'll show up in mental health for some other issue. Never gets addressed that they have a gambling problem and frequently that they have substance abuse problems. So what you want to do is work with those primary care providers and some and other health providers to see that that gets addressed in those other areas. So there's a lot of options for this. But my point in presenting that levels is to say that that would be a comprehensive public health response to respond to the whole range of where you either want to prevent problems or where you see them and you want to reduce them. So those are the three points that I wanted to make. And,
that's great. Thank you so much. Attorney Sullivan?
The handout from the New Hampshire Council refers to a couple of studies, one that was done in 2008 by Kessler, and then another one, Petrie, in 2009. I think those are the two that have been really relied upon. Are those available? It seems like there's so much reliance on those. Do you have, can you get copies of those? Or?
Yes, I'm sure we can get you either connected to or linked to those.
Yeah, that'd be great.
I'm going to try to do that.
And anything that's more recent than that, too, because it's only 5 years ago, but still, if there's anything more recent.
I'm not sure which they refer to. Which is the Kessler referring to?
It's in 2008. That's all I know. It doesn't really say much more than that.
It's in the New Hampshire Council on Problem Gaming handout. It's referenced.
No, what's the fact that it's returned to?
Several. It talks about percentages, estimated problem gambling. They extrapolate from that how many there were would be problems in New Hampshire. Okay. It's links. It says gamblers are going to have time more likely to abuse alcohol, drugs, and time more likely to have alcohol.
Okay.
Because I just like to read these existing. There's always a context is always important too.
Sure.
I've heard actually that it goes sort of flip that and it's actually that people who have other disorders are much more likely to become having issues as opposed to,
It works both
ways.
Exactly. Exactly right. Yeah.
If you could send the references to me, then I'll make sure they go out.
That much. Yeah.
Yes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Good morning, Kathy.
Good morning.
What percentage of your time at the council in Massachusetts did you receive calls from New Hampshire citizens?
I couldn't say the percentage of time, but I know we've looked at those numbers, and I'm terrible on remembering numbers,
sure.
But there's a significant number. I want to say maybe in the last X number of years, maybe 300 or so calls have originated from New Hampshire to our helpline. Probably more telling is the numbers of people searching our website who are originating from New Hampshire, and that's maybe in the 900s in the last two or three years, something like that. Doesn't tell you what they're looking for. Maybe they're one of you looking for information, but we're guessing that a percentage of those are people with problems.
Sure.
The trick is we're not in any way, worried about trying to talk to them. The issue is we don't have a place in New Hampshire to refer them. We can talk to them about where the Gamblers Anonymous meetings are in New Hampshire, but we can't say, go to your XYZ treatment center. We can't say, go to your New Hampshire Council, that kind of thing. So there's a significant number, and I can get you those numbers as well, and I can send those to
Chairman
Ames, and you can pass those
around. Yes, Senator Rush.
Just a comment, and because I do not know if it pertains to the gambling disorder section, but because I read a lot of medical journals, etc., the statistical manual number 5 is very controversial within the medical community. I think it probably has more to do with some of our other mental disorders, but this is not uniformly accepted within the medical community, and I don't even know if you're aware of that.
I know every time a new version comes out, there's a lot of discussion and controversy over it, but it's sort of the standard that they're working on. They don't like some things and they like others. Right.
Yeah. All right. Okay. All right.
And, your question on New Hampshire, and me saying that there's no place to send people to in New Hampshire when they do make calls to our office leads me into, Ed having a chance to talk about the New Hampshire Council.
Yeah, Mr. Talbot.
Thank you, Chairman Ames, and authority members for the opportunity to be here today. I'd like to tell you a little bit about me and my background. Like Mark, I started as a social worker probably not in the settings that Mark did. I started working in the oldest operating jail in the United States. I began as a social worker and retired at the end of 2002 as chief of staff of the Bristol County Sheriff's Office, spending most of my correctional time working with addicted offenders. Following that, I worked with AdCare Hospital of Worcester, the primary substance abuse treatment center in New England, did community service work for them, as well as doing consultant work and serving on the board of directors for the Mass Council on Compulsive Gambling. But most importantly, I am also a recovering compulsive gambler with 35 years since my last bet. I have owned a home in Madison for 22 years. It has always been a vacation home until about 4 years ago. I bought a brand new one and told my wife, this is going to be our retirement home. While working on the board with Kathy in Massachusetts, I always expressed a desire to work in New Hampshire with the New Hampshire Council. That was kind of fledgling at the time, being operated by someone out of Vermont. Kathy's retirement led to a partnership, and for the last year or so, we've been running around the state trying to drum up support for the for the New Hampshire Council on Problem Gambling. We have yet to talk to anyone who discouraged us or didn't feel that there was a need. I'd like to tell you a little bit about what we propose as the New Hampshire Council, what services we can provide. But I'd like to read the statement that we adopted, the mission statement for the council. The New Hampshire Council of Problem Gambling is a private nonprofit agency created to address the social, financial, and emotional cost of problem gambling. The council provides information, education, advocacy, and prevention services, as well as referrals to treatment for problem gambling and for those affected by problem gambling and the community. One of the things I like to address is what we're not and what we are. We are not standing on a soapbox railing against legalized gambling. We take no position for or against gambling. We do not provide bailouts for any problem gambler, addicted gambler. As a recovering compulsive gambler, I can tell you that it took me 8 years of working part-time outside the home to pay off the debts I incurred from gambling. I was responsible for the choices that I made in getting into a habit that I couldn't control. I believe that that responsibility also has to cover over into recovery and being secure in recovery. What we do choose to provide is services that will lead to us being a resource in the state for people who have a problem with gambling or those affected by problems with gambling. As Kathy mentioned, in Massachusetts, there are a lot of prevention services directed to certain areas. I've done a lot of work with the Massachusetts Council and on my own in the criminal justice system. Having worked in the criminal justice system for years, I know that there was no screening for gambling problems in almost any facility in the state. 5 years ago, I did a presentation to probationers in Suffolk County. And a gentleman in his 40s came up to me after, and he said to me, you know, you hit the trigger. He said, I love to gamble. He said, I get in trouble gambling, drink and drug, I get arrested, and they treat my substance abuse problem. I never, ever dealt with a gambling problem. And I know there are people who shift from one addiction to the other. I know if I had continued to gamble, I probably would have had a problem with alcohol because it was more and more drowning my sorrows. But I think we have to address the different areas as well through our prevention services. Providing a helpline, providing a website, getting involved with social media, especially today, so people can access information regarding this disease. But more than ever, there's a need in the state. As Josh mentioned, there's absolutely no funding. But we don't know of anybody that's trained to treat a problem again. There are four Gamblers Anonymous meetings operating in this state, mostly in the southern part of the state. In Massachusetts, there are 50 12-step programs. Those are the things that need to be. We need to work with the recovery community, partner with them, because they're all part of this as well. I'd also like to address a question Representative Webber brought about the industry itself. I worked in the industry. I worked at the dog track. I worked there for 11 years. It was a part-time job, and I went right up the ladder and became an assistant for the racing secretary and a judge on the finish line two nights a week. The only requirement for that last position was that I didn't gamble, but I was gambling every night. I had other people place the bets. So, yes, there is positively the opportunity of being in the industry to get involved with. These services are needed not when a casino is built or when gambling is expanded. They're necessary. There are people in New Hampshire who have a problem, and there has to be an access that they can get to, that they can reach, who will understand that problem. In my own family, I had people who detected that I had a gambling problem, but I wasn't ready to listen. But when you are ready to listen, you have to reach out. I tried to stop gambling on my own many times. It never worked. The only time it was ever successful was when I reached out. And if there's an understanding voice on the other end of that line, which is something I've seen in the field from people that worked at Mass Council, would get the call, and then they'd be sent to me or contacted about getting them to a meeting or getting them some help. I felt it was vitally important. They were already pre-screened, already ready to go. That's so critical at that time, because you only get that one moment to capture the person. I believe in a comprehensive approach. I'm here today because I involve myself in self-help meetings. I involve myself in professional counseling. I developed a completely different lifestyle from the lifestyle I had, and I developed a different relationship with a higher power that I choose to call God. When I was driving down here this morning from Madison, I was thinking how beautiful the morning. It was absolutely gorgeous coming down here. That's something I don't take for granted anymore. I had two brothers when I was doing my gambling who had vacation homes in New Hampshire. They were both skiers. And I said, I can't believe that they drive up here, fight all the traffic on Friday night, ski Saturday, maybe get in a half day Sunday, then drive all the way back. They both sold their homes, moved out of state, and I'm the one with the place in New Hampshire. I'd be glad to handle any questions related to that and what the council can do.
Attorney Sullivan.
One of the things that struck me in your handout was the number of adolescents that are estimated to gamble between 14 and 21. That's an astounding percentage. What kind of gambling is being engaged in that age bracket?
If you had to ask me what the leader is, I'd have to say right now it's probably Texas Hold'em Poker.
Okay.
And I have yet to meet a young person who was dealing with a problem with Texas Hold'em Poker that didn't think he was going to be the next invited guest to the Wall Street Journal. Delusional. And it's amazing the damage that we had one come through our substance abuse treatment program in ADCAP, who tuition fees everything at that law on Texas Hold'em Poker. And a substantial amount. The parents had no clue. So that's one sports betting, certainly.
It's been asking about the sports betting. Yeah.
That's Texas Hold'em. Is that in homes more than anywhere else or online?
Yeah, I would say it's more on campus.
Yeah.
I think your point, though, about on homes is really one of the things we've heard over and over again once this problem was discovered with a teenager. Is that the parents thought, oh my gosh, we thought we were doing the right thing. We saw they're in the basement with their friends, they're not drinking, they're not drugging. They're just doing that, can't be a problem.
Commissioner Barson.
That's why the awareness piece is so important.
Thank you, good morning. You cited in this handout, you cited a 2010 study, 37 states where the average expenditure per capita is 34 cents. My question is, are you citing, and it comes out to a New Hampshire, $451,000 annually, if we follow that formula. Are you citing the formula because this is a formula you recommend? You citing it because you think it's a baseline? I mean, as far as dollars should be committed?
It was cited more to the point that there are only 13 states that don't address problem gambling. New Hampshire happens to be one of those. And based on the average of what is recommended.
Thank you. Then my follow-up.
Yes.
Is there a best practice? I mean, we're looking at Massachusetts, $15 to $20 million when everything's operating is within your world, is there a best practice? Is there an ideal formula we should be looking at?
Can I address so I'm the board president for the Association of Problem Gambling Service Administrators, the group that created that report in 2010. And actually, there's a 2013 version of it at apgsa.org. You know, are we advising as a group? What we're concerned about is that we're able to use each other to identify what the best practices are. Just because Iowa or Oregon sits at the top of that chart doesn't necessarily mean that they're implementing best practices in the field and that they have it figured out. It just means that they have more funding. I think there's a lot of highlights that are out there, practices from state to state. But I think overall, what Kathy had mentioned, what's a good, solid public health approach to addressing this issue, to make sure that it goes all the way from prevention and that treatment is offered for people who need it and can't get it in other ways. And I don't care whether it's 34 cents per capita or $2.10 or whatever it'll be in Massachusetts once it's fully functional, what's a really good strategy, and that's what we're really striving for.
Thank you.
Are we all set? I think we're all set. So thank you very much for coming. It's really been enlightening. All right, it's 10:30, and we're going to move into the reports we've received, begin to work through issues that have been identified. We're going to start with existing gambling in New Hampshire, currently authorized gambling, and some that's not authorized. Then we'll move on into expanded gambling. Probably won't get to that until next week, the expanded part. I've asked Attorney Williamson to take the lead on walking us through the key points related to current gambling, and we'll do the same when we go to expanded gambling at a point later on. Perhaps next week we'll be able to look back at current gambling and make some preliminary choices, decisions on recommendations that have been offered so that we can start working on follow-up actions. But the first part of this process is trying to understand what's being presented. I did want to say that this is complicated. There are many facets to this issue of both at the current level and expansion levels. At times, I know to me, it seems overwhelming. There's just so much stuff to get one's mind about. But backing up from that a little bit, I think there are some key decision points. And if we can work through those decision points, I think we'll be able to move down the road to doing what's been asked of us. So I guess I'm saying don't get lost in the forest. There's a larger perspective that will be helpful. So why don't I turn it over to Attorney Williamson to walk us through the current gambling.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and I guess I'm the creator of the forest, but hopefully we'll also be able to drop some crumbs along the way and get us out of the forest, if you will. What you have are really two large documents. The first large document...
I just want to interrupt, I'm sorry. The documents we're looking at are in front of all the members. There were a few copies when we started out that were on the table there. They disappeared, I hope, into good hands. And the reports are now posted, I've just been told, on our website, which is at www.nh.gov/GROA. So they are posted. You can look at them there. I guess somebody's checking to make sure.
Oh, yeah, that's right. Tonight.
Trust but verify. Trust but
verify.
Let me go somewhere else and come back. You have to go to the today's date. It's not under documents and reports. So.
But it's there.
Yeah, it's just under October 24th meeting report. Yeah.
It would be helpful if there would be a link from the documents page, because otherwise people are not going to be able to find it.
Okay, at least it's there, and it just requires some sleuthing, so not to worry.
So like Prego, it's in there.
Yeah, just pausing for a moment, but I think we can go ahead. Why don't you go ahead?
Okay. As you know, the RFP for this project broke the deliverable out into Area 1 and Area 2, and Area 1 was a examination of existing gaming sectors here in New Hampshire, and it also required some analysis of those of the overall expansion in existing sectors in terms of some comparator states that were identified. And so what you have with the first document is an analysis of the existing sectors, and then the second part of that is a quick sort of handbook synopsis of a general overview of the regulatory structure in each of the comparator states. There are 9 of them. Again, it's very baseline and very basic, but it gives you an idea of the structure and the availability of options. The second document, which we'll get to later today, or hopefully, is Area 2, and that is an analysis of the legislative proposals that were considered in the 2013 legislative session. And so what that includes is an analysis of House Bill 678, which was a video lottery-only proposal, House Bill 665, which was a proposal that considered both video lottery terminals and table games, and envisioned 2 destination resorts, and then Senate Bill 152, most notably the omnibus version, which envisioned a single high-end gaming facility. So what we did in this document is to look at the 2 House bills, very important to look at the continuum of things that have been considered in New Hampshire. Both House bills are very illustrative of many ideas and concepts that flowed into the Senate bill. And basically, the framework that White Sand chose as far as making a manageable deliverable to the authority was to use the omnibus bill basically as a framework for the discussion. Just as far as identifying key policy considerations and then what are the options and alternatives under each of those. So circling back, I just want to emphasize that this is, it's on the website, it's available, but it is a very preliminary report at this point, in the sense that what I've done is really look at the existing sectors in terms of what the statute and the regulations basically tell me about the regulatory structure. We have been engaged in some discussion with Director Kelly from Racing and Charitable Gaming, from Executive Director McIntyre at Lottery, to understand better how those statutes and regulations actually work in practice. Because one of the things I can certainly tell you based on gaming is that, a lot of this language that you see in any enabling statute is in every single enabling statute that's out there, almost. But the way it's interpreted, the way it's implemented, is very, very radically different from state to state. So the intention is that through this process with the authority, that we will look at what has been identified to date, that we will have these workshop sessions and talk about
actual implementation, that I will continue to get feedback from the existing regulators in the existing sectors to make sure that this is accurate and fair assessment of what's happening. And then that we will have a document that is a really worthy tool for the authority to use in making its recommendations to the legislature. So I want to just, you know, begin with that. The focus in looking at the at the existing sectors was really twofold. We were looking at public accountability, meaning does the sector serve the purposes that were intended by the legislature? And then secondly, the suitability of the regulatory structure. Is the sector regulated in a manner that's sufficiently comprehensive to ensure the integrity of the product that's being offered? And I want to just say at the outset that in looking at the New Hampshire Lottery and in looking at the oversight of racing and charitable gaming that is provided by Racing and Charitable Gaming Commission, that there were no structural issues, no organizational issues cited. There certainly was no indication that resources weren't being absolutely optimized. And so that's really an overlay and a predicate to any of the other discussions that follow. I mean, obviously this is a very tight time frame. We were certainly not able to do operational or financial reviews of the agencies, but certainly nothing suggests any organizational operational deficiencies. So that's an important piece to be out there right away. So now we'll get to the individual sector. So the first sector we looked at was the lottery. And of course, New Hampshire is really a leader among the states with the Multi-State Lottery Association. You have your own tri-state lottery with Vermont and Maine. And certainly at this juncture, given the nature of lottery and the fact that it, you know, a lottery agency sort of by its nature is a hybrid in the sense that it is both the operator of the gaming sector and its regulator. And so it's unique in that respect. But, certainly there were no issues that come to mind or any specific recommendations with the lottery in its oversight of lottery operations at this point. We then looked at the racing sector, and right now, New Hampshire has no live horse and dog racing, but there is some fast racing of both horses and dogs. No real substantive recommendations there other than forward-looking recommendation in the sense that racing has been a little bit slower than some of the other sectors at really looking at technology. And the Association of Racing Commissioners International recently published technical standards on Tollestator technical standards. And that is basically the software that analyzes the betting on a race that changes the parimutuel odds through to the close of betting on that particular race. And so the recommendation really for racing was to embrace an analysis of those particular technical standards with an eye toward New Hampshire adopting those technical standards. Again, this is not an area, I want to emphasize, where New Hampshire is at all behind the curve. These are relatively new technical standards, and I'm not even sure Texas has really been the leader in working with them. I'm not even sure that they have adopted at this point. But it is something to stay current in this area that racing should look at. So that really deals with that sector. The next sector that we looked at was the charitable gaming sector. And there are two subsets under charitable gaming. One of them is games of chance, and the other is bingo and Lucky 7. The bingo and Lucky 7 probably fall more into the category of what you would expect
charitable gaming to be, in the sense that they're the traditional type of bingo and they're pool tab basic type products that are sold. Where we focused mostly in looking at some concerns and recommendations really goes to the games of chance side of charitable gaming here in New Hampshire. And this is basically where the casino night concept and the ability for a charity that qualifies to offer up to 10 nights of casino nights has basically morphed into a situation where there is offered the full cornucopia of table games here in New Hampshire. You have, you know, blackjack, full poker rooms, roulette, all the normal games that normally are offered in any casino environment. And under the regulations as they exist right now, there is a cap of $4 per wager. But when you look at definitionally the way the statute and the underpinning regulations are developed, that $4 per wager is a little bit misleading, because a layperson is thinking that the maximum bet that a person can wager is $4, when in fact there's nothing to preclude an individual from wagering $4 on every single, all 38 positions on a roulette wheel, for example. And that doesn't even get into the other types of more sophisticated bets on a roulette table. So, you know, when you have a $4 cap on a wager, it doesn't mean that that's the maximum risk of exposure. When we visited, when we looked at the regulations, and when we looked at the conduct of admittedly time constraints, just one of these particular operations, they are not being operated to the same standard as a table game operation would normally be operated. And so you really get into a situation of the need for the integrity. You know, the gaming public at these tables are really entitled to the same level of integrity and consumer protection as someone who is wagering in any type of licensed casino. Now, just as a predicate to this discussion, the commission does have quite a bit of guidance out there in the proper conduct of these table games, but a lot of it has not been converted to regulation. And because the guidance hasn't been converted to regulation, that presents an enforcement issue should they have a situation where an operator is not following the guidance. So the first recommendation, and this is at page 14 of the Area 1 report that I wanted to talk about, was the recommendation that the committee, that the authority consider recommending that there be rulemaking that would bring the conduct of these games up to the standard of a table game, in the sense that you have minimum internal control standards.
Okay, we're going to take questions as we go along, so General Fuss.
Thank you, and thank you for the report. I read through it relatively quickly last night. I wanted to ask, I thought your recommendations were more on target all, in most areas. The question I have is this, so we've been having these effectively casinos without the lottery terminals running in the state for a bit. And there hasn't been, at least to my knowledge, sort of a big problem that's surfaced. And is it because there's nobody really there that is likely to complain? People go, they gamble. I don't know of any major complaints or evidence of fraud. It's just that there's nobody really there to complain if there is a problem. You understand what I'm saying?
Yes, absolutely.
I mean, you know, you're talking about integrity, and that's important for confidence of the public. And you know, I assume, you know, my casinos run in larger states. Maybe there's, you know, professional gamblers who are, you know, have a better feel or confidence level in a particular jurisdiction. Here, there isn't any, I guess, any other really choice, but I'm sort of asking an open-ended question. Any comments on that?
Right. Well, I think that, you know, the whole concept of internal controls and the whole regulatory scheme is a level of surety in the revenue that is generated and in the accuracy of revenue reporting. And I think in the absence of internal controls, and, you know, you have, for example, the one environment that I saw was an entirely manual environment. There was a, you know, very obvious incompatibility of functions. There were procedures as far as absence of a dealing shoe and just basic controls. And so, I don't, you know, you have a regulation or a statutory requirement that a charity gets 35% of the revenue or must get at least 35% of the revenue after the cost of the game operator and after the cost of the licensee's facility. But I don't know that there's any level of assurance. They're getting 35% of something. I don't know that there. I would feel confident. And again, this is not to cast any bad faith. The tools are not in place to have the level of assurance that you would want to see. And certainly, you know, you're looking at, if you're, you know, going forward, for example, in bills, in really all the bills, but certainly in the omnibus bill, was very explicit rulemaking with regard to internal controls and rules of the game and gaming equipment and you know, all of the normal accoutrements to a gaming operation. And none of these are in place in these charitable operations. And again, the statute addresses a lot of these things theoretically, but the implementation hasn't taken place. And so, again, where the commission is able to give guidance, they have no teeth to demand compliance. So I think there is a, you know, I don't know if that answers your question, Attorney General.
So in effect, what could be happening, we don't know, but what could be happening, charities aren't getting maybe what they're entitled to, perhaps the state's not getting entitled what it's entitled to. Maybe the operator's getting a bit more than it may be entitled to, but we don't know because we don't have the systems in place to make that determination.
Exactly.
Wait, you can carry on.
So that's really recommendation one, is to look at bringing these operations up to a higher level, a higher confidence level. The second recommendation is recommendation number two, and that's at page 16. We talked a little bit before, just generally, about the importance of the background investigative process and the fact that in licensing, a very important check and balance is the segregation of that background investigation from the deciding authority. In the racing context, the Attorney General has a defined role in the assessment of the suitability of a racing applicant to do business and conduct business in New Hampshire. And in fact, it's a very robust role in the sense that my understanding is that if the Attorney General recommends against licensure, that in fact, the commission may not make a decision contrary to that recommendation. On the charitable side, with the entities that operate, that are gaming, or primary game operators or gaming employers, gaming operator employers, that check and balance is not in place. There is a background check that is done. But that background check
is done by state police and comes right back into the commission. It's I'm sure the original impetus was that you didn't need to have for a charitable gaming operation the same standard of review as you had for a racing operator. But in fact, when you have the level of intensity of the gaming product that is being offered under the guise of, or under the rubric of charity, that in fact it would appear warranted that those operators be held to the same standard of review in the sense that the Attorney General's office does a full background investigation and recommends to the commission whether that those operators are suitable going forward. So really the second recommendation is to just embrace for what you're doing in racing and what you're proposing to do in expanded gaming for this particular sector.
Okay, Senator Rush has a question.
Mm-hmm. Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I concur entirely with that, and I guess I'm not so sure this is a question to you, but a comment is that in all of the proposals for legalizing, there's money embedded in that to perform these functions, that the Attorney General's office has the revenue to do it, as do the other agencies. With the charitable gaming, the state really doesn't get sufficient revenue to perform these functions. So that I guess I'm not sure how we go forward with some of your recommendations because we don't have the revenue to go forward with it.
Well, keep in mind, Senator Rush, that it's in the normal course in gaming, the cost of the investigation and the application is always on the applicant, and the full cost of the regulatory apparatus is always on the regulated entity. Because keep in mind, I mean, you know, this is not a way you approach a normal business, but gaming is a privilege, and a revocable privilege, and that concept really it's a bargain that you make with those who come into this sector. So, you know, you do have a for-profit element built into your charitable gaming regulations right now, or your approach to charitable gaming right now has for-profit entities that are serving as game operators and as facility licensees. And in the same way that a gaming employer or a gaming operator or a technology operator would step forward and put down a deposit for his investigation and would be responsible for any excess cost of his investigation, you know, that would be inherent in any process here, because that is the normal course in gaming, and that's a normal expectation.
Okay. So thank you.
You know, I would certainly, you know, part of that recommendation or developing that would include that. The third thing that I think it's important to talk about this morning is at page 17. This is recommendation number 6. And this goes back to the 35% that I talked about. Again, under the statute, it's very explicit that where a facility is rented from a game operator employer, and that if it's a rented facility and they're using a game operator employer, then there has to be at least a 35% return. But in the current statute, RSAD:3(7), there is a provision that allows for additional fees. And it's not sufficiently developed or limited. And so the charities are subject to additional fees, which are very able to significantly undercut the 35% minimum, because it's not, you know, contracting among equals. And so if the state is serious about the 35%, then you really need to recommend a revisiting of the fee provision to see if that is more appropriately scoped Right now, the statute does have, or the regulations do have, a few exceptions which attempt to scope the fee and cap it to a certain degree, prevent certain things from being included in it. But it is still something that, you know, in its present form, can materially undercut that 35% minimum. And so I think that is an important thing to look at.
Yes, sir. Just anecdotally, too, that we certainly agree with that finding. And I think every year for the last 4 or 5 years, we put in legislation to get away that 35% be sacrosanct. There can be no fees. Typically, we originate that in the Senate, and the Senate's always approved that, and the House, regrettably, has not gone along with that position. So we see that as a flaw in a lot of things. We continually try to change that.
Director, could you give some examples and some things that are falling into that category?
There are three categories come to mind. Security, doing paperwork is popular. And we've seen paperwork fees go from zero. As a matter of fact, the smallest location in the state doesn't charge any fees, to the larger organizations that hold these games can go anywhere up to 200, 300. And I've been notified as of January, one location is going up to $500 a day for Ministerialia for paperwork, for doing the filings with the commission and stuff like that. And statutorily, it's allowed. I can't see a way to stop that.
Right. Although you would expect, if you're a normal consumer, if you are retaining a game operator to manage, that you would expect paperwork to be in that number. Or if you are retaining a facility between the manager, the game operator, and the facility, you might reasonably expect security or surveillance related to the game. So, again, I think that certainly is a weakness in the current language.
Commissioner Berkman,
just a real quick question. The undercutting of that 35%, how deep does that, have you seen that cut go?
I don't have any numbers to share with you except trying to extemporaneously, but you can, you know, at some locations, it can be quite deep. It can be 10% of their revenue, which brings it down even further. I've seen that in the paperwork. So, Commissioner, it can get deep in some areas. Nationally, in the southern tier of the state, I see those fees higher, but, of course, the handle is higher. And it confuses me because it would seem to me to do paperwork in the lower part of the state should be just the same to do in the upper part of the state. But, again, the statutes don't allow me to enforce that part. But, yes, it does cut it.
Attorney General.
Is there a big difference in the amounts of rental charge among these various groups? Isn't there a rental fee that some of the charities have charged?
There is a rental fee. The commission tries to see if that's an appropriate market. For example, one place will go, and if they charge, and I'll make a number up, if they charge $500 a night to rent it for a computer show, then we want to make sure the charities can pay $1,000 a night. Okay. So we look at that, correct.
So would $500 a night be a typical rental fee?
Some places are free. It just really depends. It's location-driven.
Okay.
Some places don't charge any fees, but they charge rent.
They charge rent. So it's just
and it's a yin and yang, because we'll have people come to legislate and say, well, we don't charge any fees, and they'll end their statement and leave, and I'll raise my hand, but wait a minute.
Yeah.
They charge rent. So, I mean, let's get all the cards on the table, so to speak.
Right.
The fee provision. Next thing that I'd like to talk about is number 8, and this talks about surveillance. And the statute is a little bit different in that it requires the game operator to supply surveillance, although if the game operator is not also the owner of the facility, there would be a disconnect in any ability to do that, because obviously the surveillance system is to a degree a fixture in the building. The other thing is that the statute allows a game operator employer who conducts fewer than 50 calendar days at a particular location to substitute practices for a surveillance system. Basically, you know, the point that's made in recommendation number 8 is that your surveillance system and what you require for a surveillance system should not be driven by who is operating the games or how many nights that particular entity operates. The surveillance function should be a function of the activity level in the room. And so if an operator is operating two nights a year, but on those two nights a year, he's operating 100 tables, there should be a surveillance function. So normally surveillance is structured by activity level, and the minimum staffing that is required of surveillance is driven by activity level. A typical casino will have, you know, three levels of staffing depending on the time of day, generally. The other thing is that surveillance is a department that it's completely inappropriate to mix a surveillance function with any other function. And so that function is dedicated, that function is performed by someone who does not have any operational responsibilities. Otherwise, you've negated the entire thing because you have a person overseeing themselves. So again, you certainly would not think of surveillance in the context, you know, charitable gaming and surveillance don't come to mind. You don't think of needing surveillance in the you know, St. Peter and Paul cafeteria. But when you have the level of charitable gaming, especially on the games of chance side that New Hampshire has, then it is viable to think in terms of surveillance. Again, it's developed. The concept is developed in the existing regulations, but it really needs to be amplified so that it's really dictated by the activity level of the tables. Next thing I'd like to talk about is recommendation number 10 at 19. This talks about gaming equipment purveyors, individuals who sell gaming equipment. And right now, there is a responsibility to be registered with the Secretary of State, but there's no licensing or registration requirement through the Commission. And normally, again, in a gaming environment, a person who's selling a roulette wheel, who's selling cards, dice, chips, etc., these, in the vast majority of gaming jurisdictions, are licensed as gaming-related casino service industries. And, you know, the legitimacy of the cards and dice and roulette wheel and everything in the charitable environment is just as valid. So I'm certainly recommending that there be at least a basic criminal background check with these individuals. I guess the conclusion of the games of chance, and there are other things identified, but the kind of the key ones that we just talked about, is that the games of chance situation that you have right now is something that has evolved over time. It's something that's going to require, some study and some reasonable approach as to where you want to be with the sector and what standard you want it to meet. But I would simply urge that the authority consider really looking at what needs to be done in charitable gaming and where you'd like to be with that, really wholly separate from any examination of a proposal for expanded gaming going forward. And one of the reasons why I think that's an appropriate way to do this is that there's no quick fix here. And perhaps properly, intelligently moving forward in expanded gaming might have present some real advantages for fixing this sector. Because if you move forward in a consideration of expanded games in a full table game operation, then you will have minimum internal controls. And you will have rules of the game, and you will have minimum staffing requirements for surveillance, and you will have the full regulatory apparatus developed, which can then be adapted and tailored back to charitable gaming in some respect, because it's going to be very important that there be a consistent approach if charitable gaming is going to continue to do these offerings. And expanded gaming may provide a funding source for being positioned to circle back and address charitable gaming.
Senator Rash has a question.
With the exception of Bingo and Lucky 7, as I read through here, to try and fix charitable gaming seems so complex. I hesitate to say this because I've got apples thrown at me, but would it actually be easier to repeal the charitable gaming and incorporate, if this commission comes out with a recommendation on casinos expansion, to repeal what we have in law now, because it seems to me almost overwhelming to try and fix it, and incorporate the charitable gaming in proposed legislation so that it could actually still fit within a casino? Because you're saying you cannot put charitable gaming into a legitimate casino because it's not regulated.
Right. I think that, while certainly an expanded where commercial casino gaming sector could help fund the remediation of the charitable, the suggestion of actually devoting square footage in a property for charitable gaming is really ill-advisable because of a perception issue. The public is not going to distinguish the two forms of gaming. And unless they are regulated to the exact same standard, then you're really talking about, a mix that's not desirable from the perspective, certainly, of a commercial gaming operator, because he now has relationships over which he has no control. And in a highly, as I pointed out in the report, those relationships are then part and parcel of his overall profile. And, larger companies coming in. I mean, and this is just one factor to consider, but, companies that are coming in that are subject to full background investigation in 22 other states really don't want to be talking about, who the primary game operator that they're working with in New Hampshire is and what does he know about them, and et cetera. So I really think that hopefully there is a way of addressing the charitable piece, at least physically, not to link the two concepts. Whether or not there is any kind of funding or whatever of the sector by the commercial gaming sector of charitable purposes, that's different. I mean, one of the things I had just kind of tossed out as an example of something just to think about is a percentage of gross revenue tax on tables that may be available in a fund for all charities to basically do a grant type program with. I mean, one of the things you do have here in New Hampshire is, my understanding is that there are more charities that want to participate than are currently, there's capacity to participate. So, my main concern was the mixing of the two. Does not, under the facts as I know them to be right now, does not seem advisable. And I don't think it's going to make, New Hampshire's talking about a competitive bidding process. You want to have, the first tier best companies that are out there in gaming want to come in here and do business. And I certainly can't speak for that. I've been in this industry a long time, and I do not think that that's going to be a particularly attractive proposal for them.
Just to take that one step further, are you saying, what I'm hearing is, first of all, don't try and incorporate current charitable gaming operations as they stand now into the same physical location as a new operation because of the different standards, differing levels of controls of the professional operator coming in.
Right.
Is the existence of our charitable gaming as we have them now, even if we don't link them, if we decouple the physical stuff, if we have the two tiers of regulation and we have keep having what we have and then we have the other thing coming, something new coming in, whatever it is our current charitable gaming going to be a disincentive for operators bidding on the new projects, in your opinion?
Right. I mean,
or is there a potential for that? Or to what extent?
You know, obviously we don't have any type of real revenue data available on these charitable operations, and have only had the benefit of seeing one physically. We certainly have talked to the commissioner and the director about them. Our preliminary sense is that to have this sector continue to stand alone and to remediate that on a separate track should not materially impact your ability to go forward with a competitive process. I don't see, at least, Jim Nickerson and Sal Sherry will speak more specifically to this next week because they've done more of the capacity aspect. But the more we looked at it, we did not see them as something that needed to be addressed and fixed immediately in order for you to move forward competitively.
That's exactly my question, so thank you.
Okay. Senator Rush?
Thank you. But if we set aside the competitiveness, and part of the reason for never expanding gaming because we were always concerned about the impact to our citizens, but if I read through here, and we have charitable gaming that we don't use a shoe, we hand shuffle, we don't know what the roulette wheel is, we don't know what the dice are, where are our responsibilities to ensuring that our citizens are protected from unscrupulous people?
Well, I'm certainly not suggesting that you not address them. I'm simply suggesting a parallel track. That, in other words, you know, when you look at, I do believe that there should be an analysis of this sector, whether or not you want to go forward with this sector, what you can do. And again, in the report, I really looked at short term, you know, what do you need to do with this? You need accounting and internal controls. You need rules of the game. You need, the basic approach that would raise the level of assurance with this sector. And then you need the long-term approaches. Do we want to continue with this? I mean, the important thing I think to remember or to be cognizant of is that a lot of states grapple with charitable gaming. The National Council of Legislators from gaming states did model rules a number of years ago because so many state legislatures were grappling with this issue. Maryland has had gaming for 4 years now, fairly successfully, and just this past summer, Governor O'Malley initiated a new oversight authority to look at charitable gaming in Maryland, which is, you know, usually on a county or local basis, and there's all kinds of things. I mean, where I live on the Eastern Shore, there are slot machines in the VFWs, and things of that nature that are, not terribly regulated. But the point is that, I'm certainly not suggesting that it not be addressed. I just think that to try to address all of it in one bill or in a series of related bills would be problematic, and that because the problem has taken a long time to build, it's going to take, a long time to fix. There are certain dependencies with these charities. You have, even if you're able to give some sort of relief or bundling with these charities, from an expanded gaming sector, it's going to be, 1-2 years before there's an actual fund back. So the suggestion, at least preliminarily, was to, initiate a real analysis, some short-term solutions, some long-term solutions, but do it outside of any type of expanded gaming legislation.
Good. Thank you. Okay, Leonard, to carry on. Well, maybe you're done with charitable gaming.
The last thing that I wanted to talk about under charitable really goes to recommendation 15 at page 22, and this is the concept of a service provider on the bingo side. It seems that there is an opening in the statute for companies like the game service providers to provide management services on the bingo side also. I mean, they're not only leasing those facilities, but they have some involvement there. And so to the extent that companies are exclusively offering those services on the bingo side, they should be subject to whatever rules are applied to a primary game operator on the games of chance side, since essentially they are offering the same service. Now, my sense is that these game operators are playing double duty and offering services on the bingo side also. So, I mean, obviously you're not doing two background investigations, but the level of review should be the same. That's basically the treatment of charitable. I don't know if there are any more questions on that, and I'll move on to your redemption slot machines and redemption poker machines. These are available in what are referred to under the statute as family entertainment centers. These are not tied to any kind of charitable purposes. These are for-profit route, basically what are called route operations, where people basically come in and set up these seem-to-be server-based systems, and they are available. In the situation that I observed them, they were actually incorporated into a building that had a games of chance facility at one end and a bingo operation at the other. And so, again, from a public perception perspective, you think this is a charitable operation, that Racing and Charitable Gaming is overseeing this, when in fact they have no authority over these particular games. The thing is that right now they are slot, that not that it's dispositive legally, it's not, but they appear to be slot machines. And right now they are entitled to offer merchandise only, excluding cash and alcoholic beverages. What's happening is that the excluding cash portion of the statute is being pushed to its limits, in the sense that cash normally is defined as currency and coin. And so it would not include the Visa debit card that is typically, from my understanding, offered by these operators when you play these games. And so there is a circumvention, a readily apparent circumvention of the prohibition on paying these in cash. I mean, my understanding anecdotally is that the Visa gift card is common, and that according to a news article I read, there was a situation where basically winnings were converted by an operator basically ordering you something online with your winnings. It's again pushed way past the merchandise only. I mean, normally when you think family entertainment center merchandise prize, you're really thinking the plush toys at a carnival. You're not really, your imagination really isn't going to what's happening here. The other thing is that these machines are basically, I think, being viewed a little bit as de minimis, because they're saying that they have to be configured so that a credit does not exceed a value of 2.5 cents on them. But there are no other definitions besides the credit for 2.5 cents. So there's no prohibition, for example, on an award of 5 million credits. Or there's no prohibition when you put $10 in this game, can you get 10 million credits? So the fact that a credit is limited to 2.5 cents is really materially doing nothing to govern the level of play at these games. So I think the first recommendation is that, you know, on an expedited basis, there has to be some analysis as to what you know, what's reasonable for a payout from these games, and whether or not the Visa card, you know, meets the definition or not. That's a public policy, you know, decision. And then there really should be some analysis of these games to see that they actually are configured and are working as represented. Now, my understanding is that these machines right now are basically licensed or authorized at the local level by the local city. There's a fee paid. It's a substantial fee. It's a material amount of money for the local jurisdiction. I don't necessarily think that it's the fact that the local jurisdiction is receiving a fee or licensing them is mutually exclusive to any efforts to have standardized regulation of these games, and to have an entity like the commission being nonetheless responsible for, you know, these games from a technology perspective, to be sure that they're configured. Because basically, you know, physically, these games do not appear, they are driven by a server, so these are just, you know, dead monitors, if you will, and you really cannot tell from looking at them what is going on with these games. You have to, as they say, look under the hood from a math and an engineering perspective to see what's really happening. I mean, these games are what, you know, could be what was closed down as illegal slot machines, sweepstakes games, and internet cafes in Florida. I mean, you can't tell from looking at them what they are. And so if this sector is going to continue, then the normal course with any type of electronic gaming equipment is a testing and certification process. Now, again, there's not a lot of technical standards that go with this right now, but if you continue with these games, then it would be appropriate to know exactly what is being offered.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes.
And an oversight on that matter, maybe you touched on it, but it's like a rule that it's only 85% of the machines versus 15 have to be real. But we have seen, and again, we don't regulate this area, but it's just, it's our, we observe that some places will say, well, they have a Nintendo hand game. The Nintendo hand game can play 50, 60 different types of games. And some people are saying, well, that's 50 or 60 games, and therefore their limit of machines can go up. Again, it's not a regulated area that I can see by any agency.
Right, you're absolutely right. There is a provision that these games can only constitute 15% of your total offerings in the family entertainment center. But as the director said, there's no governor on what constitutes a game. I mean, arguably you could have, you know, these games lined up and they're not even operable. So the 15% limitation is, you know, less than robust as far as determining, you know, what's being offered. And the last recommendation, just in the existing structure, was just a modest recommendation as to the language of sweepstakes, which I won't bother to discuss, but is in there. Sweepstakes, the definitions that New Hampshire adopted recently on sweepstakes are some really of the best that I've seen as far as addressing what can be a very problem area. And, you know, it's very important when you're offering or when you're looking to do a well-regulated, expanded gaming sector that you get your house in order with all these other areas, because, you know, you're holding, you know, racing and lottery to a very high standard. You want to hold the new sector to a very high standard. And it's important for their success, for these other type sectors, gray areas, if you will, to be controlled. So I know it's a lot, but and I would ask you to look at each one of your recommendations, but I think those are the core ones.
Okay, do we have any questions on current gaming? We shall return to this. You all set? Next time, probably. Well, we've got a little time, so I'd like to you can sketch out the structural regulatory issue that comes front and center as we look at the possibility of expanding gaming. Because I think the backdrop for it is your finding recommendation that as far as existing gaming is concerned, the current setup, two agencies, two different sets of responsibilities, suffices. There's no issue that you found with that as it applies to current gaming. So now we're turning to look at the possibility of expansion, and the question of structure comes immediately to the fore. And you could talk about that a bit. That would be helpful to us. We'll just be able to start into that.
Okay. Well, thank you. You know, when we talk about gaming structure, as I outlined, there are basically two general approaches. There is the approach where regulation is what I would call lottery-centric, where the commercial gaming sector reports through the lottery. And in those sectors, Rhode Island, Maryland, there is a use of what I call lottery vernacular, meaning that that you use the term video lottery machine rather than slot machine. You use the term technology provider versus manufacturer. And that is done, of course, because you already have an existing set of statutes and regulations that govern lottery, and you're fitting the new sector into that. The second approach is what I call a gaming agency approach, and that can really be a single agency or dual agency approach. As we talked about before, you can have a dual agency where you have a gaming control board that basically does license issuance, it does rulemaking, and does adjudication of regulatory violations, and then typically an organization that is associated with Department of Justice or the Attorney General's office that does the compliance background investigations, those kind of things. Or you can have a single agency, like the Pennsylvania Gaming Control Board, that basically has all of the functions, meaning adjudication, rulemaking, regulatory enforcement, criminal enforcement, compliance, revenue certification, in one agency. But within that agency, there's a Bureau of Investigation and Enforcement that is segregated and properly insulated so that you still have the check and balance of the background investigation being done independent of the deciding authority. So those are the two basic approaches. When we were looking at structures in New Hampshire, we basically started with the structure of the omnibus bill. The omnibus bill, Senate Bill 152, really of everything that went through the legislature last year is by far the most comprehensive approach. It built on many concepts in the earlier House bills, but it incorporates a lot of sound regulatory best practices, and it basically is a very good starting point for discussion. So in Bill 152 Omnibus, what you see is the Lottery Commission, the Lottery Commission would basically have rulemaking authority, would have the license issuance authority, and would basically adjudicate regulatory violations. And then, somewhat along the lines of the Pennsylvania model, would have within it what's referred to as a Bureau of Administration and Enforcement, who would have its own director, and that Bureau of Administration and Enforcement would have, you know, compliance and audit and revenue certification. It would have its own director that would report up through the executive director of the lottery. So basically, you would have the lottery structure. And then 152 Omnibus provided that within state police, there was a gaming enforcement unit that handled concurrent regulatory enforcement authority with on-site people from the Bureau. And then it had that particular state police unit being on-site and having a very broad definition of a gaming location that would allow it to handle all criminal-related violations related to the statute and related to that particular site. So it was very clean in that respect, and it importantly incorporated a role for the Attorney General in the background process. So, you know, it was, you know, there are questions that come up, as are identified in the report, related to just firming up or clarifying the regulatory structure in the sense that making sure that there are really clear lines of responsibility. But with the type of clarifications and amplifications that are discussed in the report, you know, that's a basic approach that is workable. Just to give you an idea of the type of kind of question I'm talking about as far as clarification would be for regulatory enforcement. Under the omnibus, it's clear that the Bureau of Administration and Enforcement would have on-site authority for regulatory enforcement. They would be on-site, would be doing audits or investigations, but also the State Police Gaming Enforcement Unit would be on-site. In the section on the State Police Unit, it clearly provides that they may initiate a regulatory enforcement proceeding before the Lottery Commission. The language in as to the Bureau's ability to do that needs to be clarified so that we clearly know, do we have two different bodies that can bring an action against, you know, against a licensee, or would at some point the Bureau have to refer to the State Police? It's, there's no necessarily right or wrong answer. You can, it's a matter of just it being clear where every, you know, what everyone's role is. So that's basically the omnibus model. Another choice, and it's a radical choice, it's a radical departure from the omnibus, is to look at a state-owned operated model, which was the model of House Bill 678, which was very much relied on in Rhode Island. And, you know, when you're looking at a state-owned and operated, it is one of the choices, but it is a choice that really needs to be examined in its implementation because, you know, a state-owned and operated, I mean, I've worked in various contexts and I have seen a situation where state-owned and operated was basically not much more than dictation from the industry or, I mean, it can run a full gamut. So it's definitely a minority view. There are not that many states that follow it. And frankly, I think it's a model that because there are certain almost built-in conflicts, it's a model that is very driven by personalities. I mean, it can work if there's a person with integrity and reasonableness at the helm of a state-owned and operated. It can be more of a problem if you have a single concentration. So, you know, that's something to be aware of. A third structure that I think you should at least think about would be to kind of borrow from Maryland in the sense that Maryland has its gaming report through the lottery, but Maryland created what's called a gaming location commission as an overlay over lottery. And what they did was, you know, in the same sense that Massachusetts is following a two-step process where they're establishing qualified applicants and then having a competitive process, what this particular commission did was basically from it basically administered the competitive process. So once the lottery had determined that an applicant was suitable and was eligible to compete, then it was the lottery location commission that actually chose the sites and who would operate them. So what it did was take out of the hands of the lottery commission the actual award of just the gaming licenses. So if there's a concern with over-concentration in one entity, or if there's a concern about, you know, just having a broader participation in the selection process, that is something that basically could be overlaid on top of a structure very similar to 152. And, you know, when you look at the Maryland statute, that agency goes away in 215. That commission goes away in 215, unless the governor were determined that it was necessary, the concept being that everything should be awarded at that point. So that's just something to think about.
Just a question for that.
Yes.
Would that model have much reference to New Hampshire, where we're looking at just one site?
Well, you're looking at one site, but you're looking at hopefully a number of operators competing for that site. So again, I mean, that would just be a way of having a sort of a fresh set of eyes on the actual selection of that operator. And so, again, it could be something that was, you know, appointed, you know, very much a part-time, expenses-only type commission that made that one-time award. It's really just an option. I know where you are fitting something into an existing agency, there could be constituencies that have concern that there's not, you know, a fresh group of players being appointed to look at this sector. So it's just something that, because of the nature of what you're looking at, could work. The third structural option is really the gaming agency option. And what's interesting about the omnibus proposal is that it is really multifaceted in the sense that when you look at the Bureau of Administration and Enforcement that is right under the executive director in lottery, what you really have created there is a gaming agency within lottery. And that's in recognition of the fact that regardless of how you do this, there will be additional skill sets that will need to be acquired. There will be office space. There will be a different group of responsibilities and duties that will need to be addressed. And so if you wanted to explore a gaming agency, you would basically just be pulling that Bureau of Investigation and Enforcement out and having that be Gaming Control Board, and basically would be melding the license issuance, adjudication of regulatory violations, and rulemaking that the lottery has, and the compliance audit and revenue certification that the Bureau has, and that would be one agency. You would maintain the Attorney General's involvement in backgrounding, and you would maintain the state police involvement in regulatory enforcement and in criminal enforcement. And so you really, you know, those are the basic choices that any jurisdiction deals with. And with the omnibus version, you know, you really have an ability at this point to really choose either. I think that obviously there are some synergies with lottery. I just think that the initial cost of entry, you know, whether it's spent out of the lottery budget or a new budget, is going to be comparable. And, you know, the proposal includes a central system to drive the analysis of the slot machines or video lottery terminals, and that's going to be used for revenue reporting. So but that system is totally independent from any system that exists at the lottery now. And so, again, you're just positioned at this point that you can rationally consider either. I think without a material cost impact. Again, there could be factors that I'm not aware of, but basically at this juncture.
General Fuzzy.
In the lottery centric states, I'm going to ask Professor Burroughs, and that was his name from and frequently the states have started with sort of VLT or slot power only models, and a lot of skill sets that are sort of already there. And then, you know, as time went on, they added table games, and, you know, it's already there, so they continued with that model. Have states chosen to put it in lottery when day one they're going to table game and video lottery terminals?
No, I mean, I haven't done an exhaustive review, but a lot of times the video lot. First of all, I think I just want to make a kind of a clarification. You know, with the exception of New York, which has very specific a very specific product that is different. It's selection without replacement. It's a very different product. Other states that have, for example, Maryland has video lottery terminals because they are the same, they're under the lottery. But I've written the definition of a slot machine for Pennsylvania and a video lottery terminal for Maryland, and they are the same. But the perception has been a lot of times that there were, you know, a willingness with lottery, an existing agency, well-run, people are comfortable with it, and so the envelope to push out in gaming under a lottery sometimes was easier for certain states. It's really a play on years ago that somehow it wasn't casino gaming if it was on a riverboat or if it was on a barge. I mean, there were, you know, gyrations. And certainly with technical standards, I mean, you can have there be distinctions between a video lottery terminal and a slot machine, but in practice anymore there's not in the majority of states. So it's really just a choice.
Just to not sure you answered the question. The question, maybe. So that what I heard was. That where the starting point was the combination of slot machines, or call them what you will, mm-hmm. slot machines, DLTs, plus table games, that did not start, the question is, did that start in an entity other than, did that start in a lottery-based system?
You know, again, it really depends on the state. Pennsylvania, for example, started with a gaming agency as slots only. There was never a consideration of placing it under lottery. Maryland started slots only under lottery. It really depends. I think one of the things that has, the synergies that's out there that's relatively new is the concept of the central system. You know, Pennsylvania in 2004 was really the first jurisdiction that did a central system for slot machines. States like New Jersey and Nevada to this day do not have a central system. There are alternative internal controls.
I guess what I'm asking is New Jersey and Connecticut, I think, have gaming control commissions or whatever mm-hmm. they call it. It's not in lottery. And they had table games from the get-go. They
right.
were full-blown.
Right.
Casinos. Nevada is probably the same. My question is there a state that has started with a full resort type casino or a distinct casino game? Slot machines, let's call them slot machines just because they have slot machines and game and table games, and decided to place it into lottery. That I'm not sure I can think of a state, but there might well be ones.
I'm not.
And I can see, and what I'm saying is I can see if you're running slot machines or video lottery terminals.
Right.
the logical place to put it is in the lottery,
right?
Because they sort of have a skill set.
Right. So. No, I'm not aware. I mean, I'm thinking there's so many different nuances with, you know, Ohio started with a commission recently, you know, Pennsylvania with a commission, Maryland with lottery. They're sort of the biggest recent entries, but, you know, certainly where you're debuting with both table games and an electronic product, that the gaming agency is, you know, I mean, some of it depends on scale also. You know, when you look at, you know, Massachusetts, for example, and I mean, what they're doing for four properties is on a grand scale in comparison to, you know, Ohio brought in four properties, you know, and then went on to video lottery terminals in their racetrack with far less, you know, robust approach. So some of it is scale. I mean, I think that, you know, definitely with a larger footprint, the gaming agency and the fresh start is the way to go. I think that where the lottery comes in as a viable alternative is really driven by scale here in New Hampshire.
Interesting.
Attorney Sullivan.
I'm sorry. Is there any preference on the part of the operators who would be competing for licenses for one model or the other, the video lottery, under lottery, as opposed to their own slot machines? And I see that Maryland's getting out of the video lottery and turning it over to the operators, and zero reason.
Well, a lot of times the lottery models are in states where the state elected to be much more involved in the operation. I mean, we had Director Albans here, Rhode Island. He basically runs the operation. And that was something that they, from the public policy perspective, were comfortable with. And that's a natural evolution, because lottery operates state lotteries. So it works for them. You do not see situations where gaming agencies operate commercial gaming facilities. So, you know, I don't know if that basically, I know there was another part of the
question. Yeah, well, one is whether or not the operators themselves have a preference.
I think it depends. I mean, certainly the operators do not want to be micromanaged. They do not, you know, when you as a state decide that you're selecting the slot or video lottery,
yeah,
and I work with Maryland, then you're saying, look, that state employees have an expertise that an industry person doesn't have. I mean, you have, you know, directors of slot operations who are paid a lot of money because they know how to design a slot floor.
Yeah.
And so, in a sense, if the state becomes too involved in day-to-day operation, you're turning your back on the expertise that this industry can bring to the table, or that the industry can bring to the table. So, you know, I know in Maryland at the time, there was a lot of collaboration with the industry and with the operators as to the floor mix and what the floor would look like. And so it worked, because the state, Director Rubel there, was very collaborative with them and basically did not impose his will over them. So it worked. But if there was an attempt to make those, you know, obviously those kind of things make a jurisdiction less attractive, because this is what these companies do. And you know, the effective tax rate is a partnership in many respects, but you know, you don't want to turn your back on that expertise.
Yeah, this is not a question as much as a comment. In New Hampshire, it seems that we tend to try not to have large government agency involvement. So, I mean, it's something that we also want to consider going forward, too, because it seems that, based upon what you said with Rhode Island, what ends up happening is if you have the state agency, it's basically, it has a lot of influence over what the private business is doing. Mm-hmm. More so than you would see in operations, as opposed to what you would see in other states that don't have that now.
Right, and just to speak to the, you know, and I can't speak really specifically with this, but, you know, the budgetary issue, the capital outlay, it's one thing to acquire a central system, but when you go to obtain 15,000 video lottery terminals and a service contract to go with them, that's what, you know, Maryland started looking at that. And the initial, that's very problematic with the initial funding of an agency, because they had sort of budgeted like equal parts for 4 years, and then the cash outlay in year one and two was much higher, and you know there was a mismatch. So what they've done in Maryland, when they just recently by referendum did a sixth property, was to tailor the tax rate back to recognize that the cost of the operation of the terminals was going to be shifting to the operators. But you know that's going to be very workable for them.
I guess I missed your point, Attorney Sullivan, your comment there at the end. What were you?
Well, it's just that, you know, this is sort of a comment, not a question, that it strikes me that New Hampshire, you know, look for your dice, they keep the government out of our business. And obviously, you're going to have government involvement and oversight of any gambling operation. Well, except for maybe the slot machines at Winchester. In any event, so that you would want to have less government involvement in the operations of a casino. And when we had the fellow from Maryland here, they were very much involved in the operations of what is, you would think of as a private enterprise, but really as a state enterprise with some private involvement. So. Because I'm just thinking out loud, perhaps more of a comment than anything else, that it seems sort of odd to me, being in New Hampshire, that we would have a lot of state involvement in the operational level of a casino.
Okay, how are we doing?
I was just going to say, following up on that, I mean, coming to this, I have, it's been a real eye-opener for me, because coming to it absolutely cold, I mean, conceptually, I have always thought, well, I think I'm more comfortable just on a conceptual level with having the state run the whole thing. I mean, quite aside from the issues of capital and how do you get it started and all the rest of it. But I'm coming around enormously in my thinking to see that there are other internal issues with that as well, aside from the fact that we are very much have a state identity as a live free or die and let private enterprise do what private enterprise is going to do type state. So it's this whole process has been very interesting for me, and assumptions that I was making that don't seem to actually now relate at all to reality. And I think a lot of us in the legislature may be working. As much work has been done, and there's been a huge amount of work done by many, many people, and, you know, as many seminars and educational things that we've done, I think the other thing I'm perceiving is that there's a lot more that needs to be done in terms of both what is happening now and what the options are for other things that may or may not happen.
No.
Oh, over here.
two sort of comments, I guess, on both the Attorney Sullivan and your comment. The we in the previous commission I was on, we did have the, I don't know what his title was, but the gentleman who oversaw Ontario casinos, which I think are state. You tell me.
State owned,
and he strongly dissuaded us from taking that model. He said, you get all of the problems and none of the real controls if you're going to do it right. And I think they license it out to Caesars and others, other operators. So I have always thought that maybe owning it, in effect, is maybe not the best of ideas. That, to the NATO, is different than whether we, how much the state chooses to spend on the regulatory side of things. And your comment before is like, something like, it's a privilege that can be taken away, and there's a source of funding. Unlike some of the other things we do in New Hampshire, I think we have to be smart.
smart about how we set up our regulatory scheme and not cheapen it out.
Yeah, and I can't emphasize enough, I mean, obviously I'm not a spokesman for the industry, but there are certain standards, and operators are generally comfortable coming into a jurisdiction that is operated, you know, that there's that real sweet spot of where there is enough regulation that you're not going to be jeopardizing your license in a stricter jurisdiction, and that it is collaborative and innovative and allows you to stay competitive with this product. I mean, one of the things, you know, that I've certainly learned over the years, and I've been doing this, you know, a long, long time, is that I can never, you know, I could never walk in here and say, do it like New Jersey, because this is always changing and always adapting, and you want to make sure that your statute is really nimble, that you can allow an operator, when the latest product or a device comes out, that they're able to get that on the floor and offer that to the public in a way that really expedites it, but in a way that does not compromise your the whole overall integrity of your scheme. For example, I don't know from an administrative law perspective here in New Hampshire, but just by way of example, you know, especially in the late 90s, early 2000s, when ticketing came in and slot systems and bonusing, there was just, you know, in a short period of time, I'm sure you've seen this in lottery, that just there are just bursts of technology. And, you know, if you have a process where you can kind of temporarily adopt regulations and floor test things, and so that you're getting them on the floor and available to the public and you're sort of in the game without compromising your overall approach, it's really important because this more so than other areas will not remain static. There'll always be something new. I mean, that's the thing that actually makes it, you know, such an intriguing business to work in, because the technology and the variety of approaches, and even, you know, even the accounting controls. I mean, years ago, you know, when I first started, it was, you know, all your minimum accounting controls were, you know, is the security department or is the surveillance department looking at the accounting department, et cetera. Now, all the internal controls have shifted to who's my IT administrator, who is the security administrator on this system, who the logical and physical access to these systems supersedes anything that you're doing on the floor. And so, you know, you really want to have a scheme that is really responsive.
Okay, I think we're about to run out of time. This discussion has been very interesting. We still have some choices we're going to have to make. I think if you move away from the state-operated scenarios, which I think probably we're going to do, you still have this question of, to use your words, lottery-centric, or standing on its own feet, the gaming commission idea around casinos. And we've got to figure that one out. What are the pros and cons? Maybe we need to explore those pros and cons, comparing those two options a little more. And I think within each of those options, there are opportunities to further develop them one way or another. You mentioned the Maryland sort of add-on of sort of farming out to a separate place, separate commission, the actual choice of licensee. Within the lottery-centric model, you could have a more carefully articulated definition of the commission's role versus the executive director's role versus the lottery and gaming division. You can tease that out and define it as part of the statute of the choice to go with a lottery-centric system. So I think we've got a lot to talk about.
And Mr. Chairman, if I could just add that something that
I didn't develop in the report that should factor into your thinking is that if you do the lottery-centric model, I don't know right now if the lottery commission is full-time or part-time. I believe it's part-time. Does that change any dynamic there?
So, more to talk about. All set?
Thank you.
Okay, until next week.